Okay, so now we're going to introduce ourselves. My name is Dr. Annabelle Bejarano, and Dr. Vicky Nays almost pronounced it correctly. I'm on faculty at UCSD in the Department of Psychiatry, and I work with adults, but I primarily specialize with children and teenagers who've been victims of different forms of trauma. I'm also bilingual and bicultural. I'm originally from Colombia, Bogota, Colombia. So most of the families that I work with tend to be Latino families, Spanish-speaking families. Also, my training, I'm not from California, I'm living there now, but I was raised in New York, and my academic training was through CUNY, through the doctoral program CUNY, but my practicum training, meaning all of the clinical experiences that I accumulated until I went off to get my degree, were primarily all in East Harlem. So that for about 5 or 6 years, I primarily worked with African American families, Caribbean families, Puerto Rican families, Dominican. So my specialty is multicultural psychology and ethnic identity issues among individuals of color and people from collectivistic communities, which is what we'll be talking about today. And I'm very happy to be here with you today. I'm also very aware that although I have training in terms of the academic and clinical training, you all are the experts in terms of Katrina. So I don't pretend to be an expert on Katrina. I will talk about what I know, but part of my goal is to help you learn from one another what you've been through and how we can all move forward in this using your experience as a guide. So we're all very aware of this, I think. And let me just move on to the next presenter.
All right, I'm the person who's been telling you what to do. My name is Guy Seymour. Mostly, I'm a police psychologist. I work with about 65 police departments and 22 fire departments, 2 federal law enforcement agencies, and the Caribbean Council of Police Commissioners. And most of what we talk about is disasters, things that happen when things go really wrong. And we've been focusing a lot on natural disasters, hurricanes, earthquakes, tornadoes, tsunamis, whatever. Originally, I'm from Guyana. Used to be British Guyana, South America. And then I went to college in Puerto Rico. And every year, 3 years I was in college, we had a hurricane that came to our campus in Puerto Rico. And I went to graduate school in Boston, which was a personal tsunami. Couple 8 degrees above the equator, which is where Guyana is. When it's cold, it's 77 degrees, and when it's hot, it's 120. And being in Boston, when it's cold, it's really, really cold. Anyway, I live in Atlanta, and I work in Atlanta and in Massachusetts. And I've been in your city 4 times since Katrina. Each time it's been an eye-opener, because things really have gotten better. You know, people say, oh, it doesn't look any different. Not true. First time I came here, there were cars in the trees. There were cars in the trees. I haven't seen any cars in the trees the last time I was here, which was about 6 years ago. So, of course. I don't know yet, because I got it last night, and I've just been walking around where there was very little impact. So, we're going to have a tour again.
Well, I haven't heard back.
Bob has a friend who has a bus who's going to give us a tour of the areas that are least recovered. But anyway, a lot of what I do is training for large-scale mass casualty, mass fatality activities. And I have to tell you, the most important thing you will do to prepare for disaster is to get to know your team. That's the most important thing you do. You cannot do this stuff by yourself. You just can't. If you try to do it, it will eat you up. It will burn you out. It will make you cynical. It will kill your spirit. So don't really do that. You need a pal. You need a team member. You need a buddy. You need somebody that when you give them your package, I'm going to tell you about the packages you need to have if you're going to do this work. It's going to have your health insurance card and a copy of your passport and a copy of your driver's license and a copy of your will. You're going to hand that to your team member. Your team member's gonna hand that to you. And you're gonna know, this is somebody I can safely trust with all the important things in my life. But if you don't have that going into a disaster, you're in trouble. You're just in trouble. Doesn't matter who you are or what other resources you have. If you don't have a team member, somebody you trust to have your back, you are in trouble. So the most important thing you'll get, hopefully, out of today, is that you'll know the people that you're going to be working with the next time something happens. Believe me, folks, it's not a matter of if, it's only a matter of when. I said probably too much.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'm Bob Atwell. I've been to New Orleans a lot. Got family here. Got a stepdaughter who came down here to go to Xavier, married a young man. They got they had to evacuate, get out of here. Fortunately, his daddy, the bus driver, and they all loaded up on his bus. And took about 40 people on that bus, and ended up, I think, in Albion, Lafayette. And kind of just living in shelters for a couple of months. Then they came back and realized everything was gone. And so she packed up and came to Denver, where me and her mother lived, and so she could start back to school on time and try to push forward with her education. So I'm a psychologist by profession. See up there, it says I'm the president of the Association of Black Psychologists. I think that's a pretty important thing. They elect me to and I'm their whipping boy. So, every now and then I get some perks out of it. That's one of the reasons I'm here. They sent me an email and they wanted to do some training. We were doing some fair amount of work with people who were evacuated to Denver. About somewhere between 10 and 12,000 people left the Gulf area and ended up in Denver at Loudoun Air Force Base in a project I call Air Amistad. Since a lot of people didn't know where they were going until they got on the plane. And what we're talking about is people whose lives have been torn up and were in very confused, agitated states, who were packed together in unsanitary conditions, put on a vehicle of transport without being told where they were going, and in many cases separated from their families in the transport. And that sounds a whole lot like what happened on the Amistad. That's why we call it the Operation Air Amistad. And we're here to talk about the impact of living through a storm and living through repeated storms and living through the neglect that happens after the storm. And you folks know it better than we do because you're living with the aftermath of everything. And I expect that quite a number of people here have their own stories to tell. And we're going to get to that. Part of what we're going to try to do is help you frame this in a different way. I like to think about this and talk about this as something that happens, this post-traumatic stress disorder, this PTSD that we're going to talk about today, it's something that happens can happen to anybody. And there are only three criteria that have to be met for you to get PTSD. You gotta live through a trauma. If you die, you're not a candidate for getting it. You gotta come through that trauma without significant brain damage. Because if your brain physically gets severely damaged, you won't get PTSD because your brain just won't be functional. And you've got to be conscious. If you're in a coma,
you're probably won't experience it here.
What the research has discovered about 40 years ago, maybe 50 by now, when they looked real carefully at this business of people surviving natural catastrophes and war, was that it didn't matter whose child you were, it didn't matter where you were raised, it didn't matter how old you were. If you met those first three criteria, you probably had it. And the only question is, how bad it is. And so that what I try to help people understand, is that where I'm
looking? No.
Well, I'm gonna go without this mic. I got a pretty loud mic. What I try to help people understand, is that, can we get rid of that so I can do this? About human memory. That's all it's about. We organize our lives because we remember things. And the kind of things that we use to organize our lives, we all use the same components. All of us. Doesn't matter whether you're 6 days old or 106 years old. You form some sort of You respond to an image of what you see. And it goes into your memory. And sometimes those images are important. Like when you walk down the street and you see somebody who owes you $20. And if you couldn't remember what it looked like, you might never get your money. And I got some cousins who owe me some money. And if I see them, I'm going to ask them for it. How many people in here have specific visual memories that come up easily? Anybody want to share any of them?
Of Katrina.
Of Katrina. Oh. Visual memories. Okay. So that the visual part of that was the darkness that you couldn't see. That takes us to the next thing, which you mentioned was words. That people were saying, help, help. How many people's memories of Katrina are anchored in words? You want to share that what it was?
Yes, because as we were leaving, it looked like a wagon train. Mm-hmm. And everybody was confused, asking questions, worried about where we were going. We were just driving nowhere.
Uh-huh. And what were they saying?
They were seeking help, seeking direction.
People just asking for help.
Asking for help. Just keep going.
So that's what you remember most.
Yes, that's what I remember.
People were just, everybody asking for help. Nobody knew what to do.
Trying to find maps.
We also depend on sounds that are not words. People remember the sounds of that storm? Loud. Water rushing, makes noise, buildings collapsing, things falling off, things crashing and breaking.
all kinds of noise that gets implanted and imprinted. And normally when we think of, when I think of memories, I think of good stuff too. And like, how many people can remember the song that they danced, the first song they danced with their sweetie, with their honey with? You remember the first song?
Okay. Look, how many women can remember the first song?
Okay. How many of your husbands can't remember the first song?
Use that in life to kind of guide us. And smells are also important. How about the perfume or cologne that your sweetie was wearing when you met her? How about the smell of your grandmother's kitchen? People remember that? I discovered at one point that I had this vulnerability to the smell of baby powder and never knew why. That this girl I was dating treated me really bad. And I couldn't figure out that my attachment to her was that she used to rub herself down in baby powder. And boy, I wanted to be close to her. And I kind of figured it out that my grandmother used to always wear baby powder, Johnson's baby powder. And she held me for about the first 4 months of my life because I was premature and sick, and she brought me home from the hospital and nursed me back to health. And once I was talking to my mother and I figured that out, I went and got my own baby powder and got rid of that girl. And then there's and the other component of memory is sensations. All that kinesthetic stuff, whether we're tense, whether we're hot, whether we're cold, whether it's wet or dry, whether we're tired, all that stuff gets locked into memories. And that memory becomes how we organize our life. And in order to organize it, we assign a meaning to something. And almost always attached to that memory also is a feeling. And all you have to do for this system to work for you is stay alive. Be awake and not be brain damaged. And it works. And thank God it works, but we'd be walking around bumping into folks, not being able to carry on relationships, because we'd be reintroducing ourselves to people all the time. And we wouldn't have all that, all those wonderful warm feelings that we have about all the good times we've had with people. And so you see, this business that's so crucial, this business of being able to remember things that's so crucial and that makes life flow, is the same process that people are dealing with Katrina. Because what has happened is that the memory has now become traumatic. And changed the feeling that we get. Instead of warm, fuzzy feelings, what kind of feelings come up when people have a memory about Katrina?
Anxiety.
Sadness. Anger.
Angry.
All that stuff. Well, that's what we're here to normalize. You see, because it's not crazy people who this is happening to. This is normal people. This is how normal people react when the world goes crazy. And what happens is that people don't ask for help because they think they're going crazy. Everybody who survives a trauma thinks they're going crazy, when in fact what's happening is that their brain is functioning the way it should function. And what our task becomes is to make it okay for them to talk about that memory and all the associated feelings and the distorted meaning, distortions in the meaning of life that are a result of them having lived through the trauma. And that's what we're going to focus on today. Do we want to go right in, or do we want to?
We talked about talking about trauma symptoms of PTSD, okay. Start
that. Yeah.
And then what we thought, well, it depends on how the group is feeling. We're thinking of taking a break on the hour at about 2. If that feels just a 10-minute break, just people can get up and stretch, use the restroom, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So we can start talking about symptoms of trauma for 15 minutes.
Okay. What I want to say is that trauma changes the way people think, the way we feel, and the way we behave. And it affects every area of our existence. Our thoughts change because we dream about it. We don't get to not dream about it. You see, that's when we're most vulnerable. I mean, people find all kinds of ways to regulate what's going on. They get themselves immersed in work. They develop little routines to block out things that they don't want to think about. And then comes time to go to sleep at night, and they lay down, and lo and behold, what happens is they start dreaming. And so what we see, a lot of people who are traumatized, they don't sleep well. Sometimes they don't sleep at all. And then they do particular things to try to go to sleep, like drink themselves into a stupor. So a lot of your clients are probably doing that because they're having dreams at night that they don't want to have. They have what we call flashbacks, which are visual recreations of the trauma. And so that when a flashback occurs, what you get is more than a thought about it. You get a memory that's pretty intact. And so that what comes back is not only the image, not only the thought about it, the words you use to make sense out of what was happening, but a lot of times what comes back in a flashback are the kinesthetic sensations, the smells, and sometimes the visual images. And so that what people end up doing is they actually end up hallucinating. And it makes them think they're crazy. And not. What happens, what we've learned about traumatic memories, is that the brain holds on to that stuff for survival purposes. It's our survival mechanism. It's hardwired biologically to remember pain so that you can avoid it the next time around. And so the task of somebody who's intervening becomes to help people understand that those memories are inevitable and unavoidable, but manageable. Intrusive thoughts. That's thinking about something that you don't want to think about, when you don't want to think about it, when it's not convenient for you to think about it, and you can't make it stop. Somebody changed the channel and you can't get it to go back. And it used to be that prior to being traumatized, people were able to focus and pay attention and keep their mind where they wanted it to be. After a trauma, what you discover is that people complain about not being able to focus because they can't get this other stuff out of the way. It keeps coming back in. And it also, in its worst, starts getting people to feel really paranoid. They're very, very frightened that something's going to happen again. And you think that's unreasonable. Why are you so afraid? It's because they have no sense of control. The characteristics of a traumatic event. I should have gone over those. are that it is, the primary characteristic is that it's uncontrolled. You don't have any control over what's happening. And nothing you do gives you control. And that is life-threatening. And so that you don't have control, and your life's at risk. And possibly, people might actually be dying right next to you. That's pretty scary stuff. And so that when people are kind of paranoid and very frightened that it's going to happen again, it's because it feels terrible to be out of control. Sometimes people get so immersed in that belief that we label them delusions. That there's nothing we can do to convince them otherwise. And if it's not psychotic delusion, it's a delusion that's based in anxiety and panic. And then there's those dissociative states that interfere with the way people process information. A dissociative state is one where you're missing a piece of your memory. There's a disconnect. And so that the information that should cogwheel and come together gets separated out. What we discover is that the people who have dissociative experiences immediately after or during the trauma are going to have the most severe symptoms of post-traumatic stress. And so that's a telltale sign in the early stages of response. If you see somebody who has a dissociative experience, and we'll talk more about that. I'm trying to get us.
I would also add this one point to the dissociative states, that if you're a clinician and a client comes in and describes what seems like may have been dissociative states to you, it also is like a barometer of what you can start to imagine, the severity of the trauma they experienced may be. So something for you to understand in the framework that you have. So it's not that everyone experiences a dissociative state when they've been raped, when they've been in a car accident, or even Katrina. But those that do, you can rest assured that they were either very, very close to the epicenter of the trauma, or what happened to them was so horrendous that it's almost as though it literally overwhelms the system, and your brain can't take so much. And part of the brain's coping is to sort of detach in that moment. The problem is that it helped them in that moment to detach a bit, but later on it becomes problematic when they have these dissociative states.
In the cognitive components, is there research that tells us where in the brain, is there one place in the brain, or is it in several places in the brain, that those components cluster? Or is it, can you give us some sense of what the physiology is of the brain in this state?
Well, one area that we know about is in the hippocampus, because it allows us to put words to an experience. It allows us to inhibit or disinhibit our reaction, our emotions. And I'll talk about this a little bit later on, that with children it's a key factor that puts them at risk because their brain is not fully formed, so they're not able to really make sense of the experience. But that's one central area around trauma. There probably are others, but that I may not be versed in what the specific areas or centers of the brain are. I don't know if I have anything to add to that.
There's quite a good description of the things that happen in the structure of the brain and the biochemistry of the brain, but I think it's beyond what we're trying to do today. And there's a good explanation of it on the website for the National Organization for Victims Assistance. They have a whole thing on trauma and the brain, a whole chapter in it. And it's a very good resource, but I think it's not really where we are today.
Right. But a good question in terms of, later we'll focus on kids, that trauma, depending on the age, depending on the severity, does have a physiological impact on the working of the brain and the processing later on of information.
Thank you. Emotionally, trauma causes two primary reactions, anxiety and depression. The early stages, what we see primarily is anxiety, and extreme anxiety and panic as people try to get their arms around what's going on. And particularly when we're talking about a natural disaster. I mean, we've got a lot of different kinds of things that cause PTSD. Physical violence, chronic abuse, severe accidents, and natural disasters are probably the most prompt, and automobile accidents are the most frequently seen causes of PTSD.
War.
War and natural disasters.
What about hearing the stories of someone being in that position, hearing all these stories? Because we have all these clients who've been affected, they all have a story, and can't help them until you sat there and listen to the story, and some of it is horrible. Is there some kind of...
We call that secondary PTSD or compassion fatigue.
And mm-hmm. We'll talk about that.
And that's one of the reasons Dr. Seymour was so stressing that you can't do this alone. What we discovered, what we used to say about trauma is that you can't immerse yourself into a pool of victims and not get it on you. Sticks to you. You take it home with you at night. When you wake up, and you start to have dreams about it. And we'll talk about that. I think we'll get to that tomorrow.
We will get to that today.
Okay. And we're going to talk about that secondary victimization. Some people call it secondary PTSD. Some people call it compassion fatigue,
vicarious
traumatization. There are a lot of different names for it. But you can't be around it and not get it on you. It's like peanut butter. Sticks to you. You bump it again. You have to get something else. And so there's this range of emotions, depression, anger, anxiety, that are kind of these hot emotions that people get, that you notice, that push something out into the environment. The other stuff goes in internally, the guilt and the shame. Because people are often terribly guilty about surviving. They're not happy that they survived. They're guilty that they survived. Because somebody who they cared about didn't survive. And they frequently are asking themselves, and secondly, what they could have done differently so that their loved one could have survived. And sometimes they did some things to survive that they're now ashamed of. And so that we have to deal with this entire range of emotions. And we sometimes have to probe for the guilt and the shame. That it's not so obvious, but they're not putting that out into the environment. They don't want people to know about those feelings. There are... I mentioned that there are some significant behavioral changes that happen. Changes that we see in people who have post-traumatic stress disorder is that they begin to self-medicate. People who were not substance abusers become substance abusers. People who were pretty calm and pretty reasonable about the way they go through their life, start taking incredible risks. They challenge death. And so then we see a lot of violence, suicide and homicide. When I asked Al Matthew what he noticed about people here since the storm, he said, they're just angry. And I asked the cab driver, the limousine driver who picked me up at the airport, and I asked him, what stands out for you? He said, the murder rate is going up. People are killing each other. And so there were from two different sources that this anger comes to the surface. And it looks like character-sorted behavior. And so that you get all of this stuff, you see, this stuff, this stuff, this stuff, and this kind of rigid character behavior that looks like character disorder. But when you go back before the trauma, it wasn't there. And I think, well, that's peculiar. And we see it time and time again. And what happens is we often misdiagnose that. And so my point here is to point out that we're going to see this dramatic change in the way they manage their cognitive life, in their emotional life, and the way they regulate their behavior. And they change interpersonally. They withdraw from relationships. They stop doing things that they enjoyed doing before. They let go of personal relationships and have real problems with intimacy. They don't want to get close to anybody because they don't want to lose anybody else. You got a question?
Yes, when you talk about character disorders, are you talking about the same thing as personality disorders?
It looks like a personality disorder.
Okay, looks like.
Come on.
No, okay.
Similar to. It looks like a personality disorder. And if it goes on long enough and untreated, it becomes a personality disorder. And so we're about at a point where. Was there a question back? Somebody had a hand up back there, back there. Okay.
At the point at which it becomes a personality disorder, are there some kinds of treatment that you could still...
You go in and treat the trauma.
Even if it becomes seated at that point, it becomes sort of habituated.
Go in and treat the trauma. That's what I always say. Go in and treat... If you pull the thorn out, people stop reacting to the pain because it progressively heals. We want to take a break.
We're going to take a break.